Welcome to Net Zero with Mona, where we discuss how investors can tackle climate change, the biggest issue of the 21st century. Today, we want to take a closer look at the role of banks in funding and underwriting the fossil fuel industry. Banks are, of course, a crucial source of finance for the fossil fuel industry. They provide loans and investments that enable the production and expansion of fossil fuel extraction. And while big fossil fuel firms like Exxon, BP, Shell, and Total derive some of their capital from issuing shares, a lot of it comes from debt markets and borrowing. And that's an even more important source of finance for the industry. It's fair to say investors are increasingly starting to recognize that. And many have initially focused on engaging directly with fossil fuel firms, but increasingly looking at turning their efforts towards banks. And in doing so, the annual Banking on Climate Chaos report that's produced by a coalition of NGOs has become a really important resource. So the latest report, the Banking on Climate Chaos report, has just been published, and we want to take a closer look at the findings. So I'm very pleased that we have Léa Mumondre with us today. Léa is a research analyst at their think tank Reclaim Finance. That's a campaign group and a research body that aims to target financial organizations that hinder climate action. Thanks for joining us today, Léa.
Thank you. Thank you for having us here.
Great to speak to you. And it's interesting to actually, I had a quick look at the findings. The first impression I got here is that banks have really ramped up their lending to the fossil fuel industry. Can you tell us a little bit more about the key findings of this year's report?
Yeah, so as you said, there is a worrying trend that is demonstrated in the latest edition of the Banking Climate Chaos reports. In 2024, so the latest year we have the data for, the report shows $869 billion of funding by the top 65 banks globally towards the fossil fuel industry. That's gigantic, and that's also a very big increase of $162 billion compared to 2023. So a 23% increase, that's big. Among this funding, what's also worrying is that $429 billion of that went to companies that are doing fossil fuel expansion, and that's also a significant increase compared to 2023. And maybe in terms of key findings, what we can also say is that the report covers the period from 2021 to 2024, and since 2021, there has been $3.3 trillion of support by the top 65 banks towards the fossil fuel industry. And 2021, as you recall, is the year where NZBA, the Net Zero Banking Alliance, was founded. Also, it is the year where the International Energy Agency said that there was no need for fossil fuel expansion whatsoever. And since then, we found that $1.6 trillion went to fossil fuel expansion. So obviously, there's a massive discrepancies between what needs to be done and what banks are actually doing. And maybe in terms of key findings, if we zoom a little bit on Europe, because I'm European, so I do look a lot at European banks, we can say that Barclays, for instance, is a very, very big supporter of fossil fuel financing. They provided $35 billion in 2024 to the fossil fuel industry. It's a gigantic increase in financing from their part. And if we look at French banks, which had shown some encouraging steps last year, because some of them, BNP, Crédit Agricole, actually added to their policy and decided to stop supporting companies in terms of underwriting. They stopped bond underwriting to companies that are involved in upstream expansion. So we had some promising steps, but French banks are still like increasing their support to fossil fuel companies. And we can maybe mention a few of them, like BPCE, Banque Populaire, is the Chinese French bank. And they showed a massive increase of funding toward expansionists in 2024. They actually became the first supporter of Total Energy. So yeah, in terms of the key findings for these reports, definitely a worrying trend, a really big increase towards fossil fuel companies in general and towards expansion in particular, which is definitely a red line that banks shouldn't cross.
Thank you. That was a really effective summary and quite concerning. There was, I think, a chart at some point where the cumulative amount of finance was being shown in the report since the signing of the Paris Agreement in 2016. And that's just really mind-blowing. I think it was more than $7 trillion, which is really depressing. But also important what you highlighted, 2021, that important turning point, because that's, of course, when the Net Zero Banking Alliance was launched. So safe to say that the pledges that banks made as part of that coalition, because many of the banks that are funding the fossil fuel industry were part of that alliance, I should say, or are still are, but that doesn't seem to have been very effective if financing still increases in that period, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the Net Zero Banking Alliance was really presented as banks stepping up, banks making strong commitments. And as we've seen last year, the coalition is completely imploded. A majority of banks stepped out of the coalition. The coalition decided to drop its own commitments. And so I think what we can say about that is that banks, actually, since 2021, they haven't changed their behavior. They pushed NZBA to change its commitments. And this inclusion is actually a really pregnant example that self-regulation is not sufficient when it comes to banks supporting fossil fuel companies. And regulators absolutely need to step in to ensure that short-term profits does not prevail over a living planet, basically.
That's really important. I think I'll come back to that in a bit more detail later. I want to go back to that report and perhaps back to the basic question that I mentioned in my introduction. Why are banks so important for the fossil fuel industry?
That is a great question. I think what we can say is that fossil fuel companies, they do rely heavily on access to capital. They rely heavily on access to insurance and to investors to survive and to grow. And without this financial lifeline, they do not have the ability to pursue new projects, new expansion projects, and they also don't have the ability to maintain the existing ones, or they would be severely limited in doing that. So that's why banks, but also investors and also insurance companies, they aren't just bystanders, they're enablers in that context. And they do have the power and the responsibility to stop fueling the climate crisis. And that's why pushing them specifically to cut ties with fossil fuel companies is a really strategic lever for systemic change, also, I think. And that's also why, I mean, we're trying to be complementary to all of the amazing work already done by lots of NGOs all around the world that are already putting and challenging the social and ecological impacts caused by fossil fuel companies themselves. And we think that this added lever is really important to make it work.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I guess it makes it a powerful lever from an investor's perspective as well. One way to look at it is lending to an organization, which banks are, that betting on capital intensive industry, which is predicted to be in decline in not too distant future, is financially not really a savvy thing to do and potentially risky, right? So investors might want to consider that as well, isn't it?
For sure. They should absolutely keep in mind that fossil fuel assets are supposed to become stranded assets in the near future.
Coming back to the report itself, so one thing that stood out to me is that North American and Asian banks are quite high up on the league table. Do you think there's a specific reason for that regional concentration on fossil fuel lending?
That's a good question. I think there are several answers to that question. So maybe for the listener, just to so you understand how big of an exposure we're talking about, the top four U.S. banks in this report in terms of funding towards fossil fuel companies, there are JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo, and just them alone. There are 4 out of 65 banks, and they make up 21% of the total global fossil fuel funding. So that's gigantic. And when we talk about Japanese banks, they make up 12% of the report funding. Chinese banks also, Citic, for instance, they are very big fossil fuel supporter. So I think an easy answer maybe to your question is that these banks are already the biggest among the big banks in terms of assets. When we look at, for instance, the S&P top banks in terms of assets, the banks I just mentioned are already on top of that list. So that's also like a mathematical answer. And also maybe something that is interesting specifically for US banks is that we found that nearly half of the financing that we found towards specific companies in this report, that went to companies that are headquartered in the US. So that's also something we try to build, I think. And maybe a third element of answer would be that the regulation on this market is quite limited. And there's also like a worrying trend of anti-ecological measures or even reversal of pre-existing ones in the US among a very big boom of support towards LNG in this country. So that would be also, I think, an element of answer of why the US banks are such a big player in terms of fossil fuel funding.
And another thing that stood out to me is that underwriting of the fossil fuel industry has actually come down a little bit and then went straight back up again. So I wonder if there's a specific reason for that or...
Yes, sure. I maybe just want to specify that when I talk about underwriting, I mean, for instance, bond underwriting, and that actually only increased towards the period. So every year we found more and more bond underwriting. But the total funding, the total financing, which includes loans and underwriting, actually went slightly down compared to 2021. And again, in 2023, there was a decrease for the past few years. And we were quite hopeful that it was a good news and that voluntary commitments were actually working. And we can see this year that absolutely not. So a few elements of answer or explanation regarding these trends. So maybe just to say that we observe these shifts toward, with these reports. We cannot really speculate on the exact cause, but with that being said, so that in 2024, there was a drop in interest rates, which would make it more interesting for companies to ask for financing then. Also, some big fossil fuel clients were coming back to the market in 2024 after being absent from it in 2023, 2022. So that's also an explanation. And also, obviously, we think that the changing political context also plays into it.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a really plausible explanation. Also something that I thought, because we work a lot with the Anthropocene Fixed Income Institute as well and speak to them quite a bit. And they're looking, obviously, at bond issuances and seeing kind of an uptake of like bond issuances from big fossil fuel firms in recently. And also bonds with a really long maturity, which is interesting. I think investors tend to often focus on equity markets quite a lot. Obviously, a lot of the bank action happens in bond markets, right? Supporting bond issuance. That's in a way quite interesting and perhaps also a really important lever for investors to then engage when a bond matures and they have to issue a new one. That's when investors can put pressure, isn't it? Coming back to something you discussed right at the beginning, and I think that's a kind of a key context for us here when we're talking about banks, is the role of the Net Zero Banking Alliance in the massive exodus of banks that we've seen over the last 12 months or so. What we've seen recently now is that the coalition has kind of eased its standards for membership and dropped the binding 1.5 degree target. Do you think that will further impact fossil fuel lending?
It's difficult to say. I don't think that we can say that the QSD and the NZBA eased its condition. Then we will see an uptake in fossil fuel funding. I think the moral of the story with the NZBA is that when banks try to self-regulate with promises that do not engage immediate change, and they are like, okay, we will do that in a few years, and then the years come by and they haven't done anything and they decide to take down their premises. Now, I think in any case, the banks haven't changed their behavior during the periods. The NZBA had to admit that fact and had to admit that self-regulation doesn't work. So yeah, I don't know if in 2025 we will see the effects of this failure by the coalition. Yeah, I'm not sure it is the main driver, but I think the failure of the NZBA is a very good example of the fact that we need external pressure and also regulation.
I think so. I think that was a really interesting conclusion in the report. I mean, one parallel, I don't know if it's fair to draw that parallel, is the coal industry or lobbying, for example, insurers to stop underwriting coal. I mean, that has had a huge impact, right? I mean, the coal industry is officially sort of in decline. And I think refusal to underwrite coal played a big role in that. Do you think there's some lessons to be learned there?
I agree that it is a tempting parallel to make, but also that is a bit of a difference with the coal industry. Obviously, it's a success and then we need to draw upon it. But the coal industry, it has been targeted for a lot longer than what we've done with the oil and gas industry. And that makes a big difference over time. And also, it's a sector that is way less politically supported by countries and also way less subsidized. That also makes a difference in terms of the success of our campaigns towards it. And so I think there is overall a very clear difference in narrative and in public perception between the coal industry and the oil and gas industry. And the public perception so far has been a lot more lenient for oil and gas than for coal. And so I think we really, really need to address that and to work on that. For instance, we need to toxify narrative around LNG around methane gas, because it is actually a bad school and the public is not aware of that. And that really helps, like the shift in perception really helps to get a lot of polluting industries to stop.
Okay, that's an interesting point. And yeah, fair enough. I think ordinary people see as well, like they see petrol stations and that's where they fill their tank and they see kind of that's still around physically, like whereas coal seems to be a bit more detached for the most part from everyday life.
And also maybe just to add on that point, so if we compare the lending activities by banks towards the oil and gas industries and the insurance companies supporting the coal industry, I think there's also a big difference in terms of activities, because as an insurer, it is a lot more difficult to shift risks. It is very expensive to insure risky assets. It is very, very expensive to reinsure those assets. And so I think there's also a difference in that type of support. And as an insurer, when you are the insurer of a, for instance, a project, the damage to your reputation is long-term because your support is long-term as well.
So taking a look at the findings of the report and summing this all up, one of the key strategic pieces of advice that you have here is that you can no longer rely on coalitions or like voluntary cooperation from banks to put this into action. That seems to have failed, and that you really need to involve regulation and policymakers to enforce a phase out of fossil fuel lending, summing that up correctly. How can investors help with those efforts? Should they engage directly with policymakers rather than trying to engage with banks? Or
one thing is for certain, the way shareholders, investors engage with banks so far, it lacks credibility, it lacks effectiveness. We don't see many investors trying to engage with banks. And usually climate shareholder proposals during AGM, they achieve really low shareholder support. The majority of management proposed resolutions are approved generally with like over 90% approval. So what investors can do in terms of engagement with banks, I think, is to change radically how they're doing this. Private bilateral dialogue, which is something that shareholders say that they do a lot, it definitely is not working. And we need a lot more strong public statements. We need more votes against management. We need like an escalation process, so to speak. And we need them to really send a strong signal to these banks that fossil fuel expansion financing should cease immediately. That's one lever. It is how they do bank engagements. And then in terms maybe of support towards policymakers, or maybe call on policymakers to shift, we think that shareholders or investors should definitely support the implementation of strong transition plans for non-financial companies and for financial companies. So regarding non-financial companies, those investors should make transition plans mandatory for them to decide and invest in those companies, especially for companies that are involved in fossil fuel production and expansion. And they should really advocate for these transition plans to be standardized, to be robust, to show a decline in fossil fuel production in absolute terms, to really align with the IEA's recommendations. So that's what investors can do in terms of transition plans for non-financial companies. And also for financial companies, for banks specifically, investors should advocate and should push for more regulation to prevent the funding towards fossil fuel expansion companies. That is definitely the red line that they shouldn't cross, especially for companies that are involved in oil and gas exploration and production. So that's the upstream parts of the expansion. Yeah. And also, I think maybe one last lever, something that investors should really advocate for when they are shareholders, for instance, for a bank, they should definitely request the implementation of an energy ratio in terms of energy funding. So at Reclaim Finance, for instance, really push for a 6-to-1 ratio between sustainable power supply activities and fossil fuel activities. That's really something that investors should strive for and ask banks to implement.
Yeah, interesting. I think if I recall correctly, this is something that the New York City Comptroller put forward at Bank of America, at the Bank of America AGM, just disclosures on energy financing ratios, I think. And even that was rejected already, which is quite appalling. But then again, I mean, banks have a choice, isn't it? Like they don't have to fund the fossil fuel industry. I mean, I feel engagement with the fossil fuel industry itself is a bit of a dead end because ultimately it's their core business. So it's really hard to give up, whereas banks can strategically consider financing the green economy instead of the fossil fuel industry, and they still have a future. So from what you're saying here, it sounds like not giving up on engagement with banks is important, but at the same time also speaking to policymakers and trying to enforce a bit more binding standards.
Engagement is important. It is absolutely not sufficient. And investors have a big role to play in terms of support towards policy shifts. But I think the regulators also absolutely need to step in.
Great. Well, that's really interesting. And I really hope that for a lot of our readers, this report will be, again, a useful resource. I mean, obviously, it's available online. We've published a summary on our site as well. You can see the full report if you Google Banking on Climate Chaos. I really recommend reading it. Thanks so much for your time, Leah. That's been really useful and a really interesting conversation.
Thank you, Mina. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I hope you enjoyed listening to the podcast. We've talked so far a lot about what we shouldn't be financing. If you want to talk about the alternatives on the kind of stuff that could be financed to tackle the climate crisis, we have got a summit coming up on investing in climate solutions. That's on the 11th of September in London. And we also have the Net Zero Real Estate Summit coming up again, where we look at how the real estate sector can be decarbonized. That's on the 16th of September and again in London. So I hope I'll see some of you at these events. And yeah, I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Thanks for listening.